This week on the Dragzine podcast, I talked to McLeod Clutch's Paul Lee about how he got into drag racing, running a Nitro funny car, and we do a little bit of talk about clutches. So, pull those belts tight, get ready to put in the beams. The Dragzine podcast starts now. Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of the Dragzine Podcast. I'm your host, Senior Associate Editor Brian Wagner. And on the show this week, I talk with Paul Lee, owner of McLeod Clutches, about his drag racing journey, kind of what goes on racing a Nitro funny car, and we get into a little bit of clutch talk as well. So, without further ado, let's get this drag racing party started. All right, my guest this week on the Dragzine Podcast is Nitro funny car racer, McLeod Clutches, Paul Lee. What's going on, Paul?
Hey, man. Good to hear from you guys. Always good to talk on the Dragzine.
Yeah, definitely. I appreciate you coming on the podcast. And I know it was at your last outing, you were rocking our logo on your car, weren't you?
We were. It's still on there now.
Awesome, yes.
On the rear quarter panel, nice and big. Did you guys see it?
Yes, I did. I saw it in a few pictures, and definitely appreciate it for sure. It's kind of wild to see our logo on something other than a door car, but nothing rather see it on a Nitro car for sure.
Yeah, well, it's been a lot of fun, I tell you.
Yeah, you know, I don't think a lot of people realize, they might, you know, some of the newer fans might just be kind of seeing your name for the first time out there, and that you raced for a while before, correct?
I've been driving funny cars since 1988, so this is my 31st year, actually, so it's been a long time. Most of my first part of my career was alcohol funny cars, and I raced alcohol funny cars from 1988 up until 2005. 2004, I finished in the top 10 in NHRA, won 3 national events. We won 15 rounds in a row, beat the likes of, like, Frank Manzo, Bob Newberry, Paul Gill, guys like that. You know, being from the East Coast, that's who we used to race against all the time. So we were pretty successful in the alcohol funny car. And then in late 2004, starting 2005, we went to the Nitro funny car and raced Nitro funny car and mostly IHRA back then, because we could be competitive there and not have to spend millions of dollars. We were just a bunch of poor guys going, you know, wanting to race a Nitro funny car. And the IHRA at the time was the place to do it. So we used to do some NHRA races and mostly IHRA. I drove for, you know, Paul Smith. I drove for Jim Dunn in NHRA. I won an IHRA national event driving for Paul Smith, and then raced NHRA when IHRA did away with the funny cars. You know, went back to NHRA, and like I said, worked with, and raced with Jim Dunn. I raced, you know, for Chuck Worsham, and I worked with the Colettas. I drove for Connie Coletta, and then I had a heart attack. That's what, you know, kept me from racing the last 3-4 years was when I had a heart attack. So I'm just really getting back into racing, you know, back from the recovery from the heart attack, and basically now signed off from my cardiologist that I can go back driving one of these things. So that's what we're doing. So here we are.
That's awesome that, you know, you have a massive life-changing event. You know, you come out on the positive side of it, and then you just jump right back into a funny car. And I guess my question is, I always find this interesting, especially talk with like funny car drivers, and you started out alcohol. What was it like the first time, you know, all right, I'm going to race alcohol funny car. You get in that car and that body closes for the first time. Were you pumped or were you like, maybe this was a poor choice?
No, I was pumped, man. I wanted to race. Well, I'll go back to when I was 13 years old. I was 13 years old. I grew up in New Jersey. That's where I'm from, the East Coast. And I grew up near Atco Dragway in Englishtown. So I used to go when I was a kid to go watch the funny cars run. And when I was 13 years old, I saw Jungle Jim Lieberman race at Atco Dragway. And I just remember it like it was yesterday. And I said, that's what I want to do. So it's not something that I decided to do even at that time. I decided I wanted to drive a Nitro funny car when I was 13 years old. I always knew that's what I wanted to do. So my whole life has been dedicated towards, you know, driving and drag racing, driving a fuel funny car and drag racing. So the first time I, you know, obviously, you know, started racing in alcohol because that's what I could afford. And I had my own car. I mean, no one would let me drive their car back then. I was racing brackets at Atco and Englishtown, just, you know, super pro cars. But I wanted to, you know, obviously step up to the funny car. So I built my own alcohol funny car. It took me, took me 2 years to build because I didn't have the money. So every time I had a little money, I'd buy something. I made a little money, I'd buy a crankshaft. Made a little more money a couple more weeks later, made some money, buy a set of cylinder heads. So it literally took me 2 years to put my first funny car together, and then I went to Englishtown and got my license. And the first time out, I made my six runs in 2 days up at Englishtown and got my alcohol funny car license and never looked back. I mean, it was something that, when they put the body down, I was like, I was excited. I couldn't wait to hit the gas on it.
See, and that's cool because I like alcohol funny car because out of all classes, I've run all over the track doing my media deal. You always know when they're on the track because boy, oh boy, when you put that thing on the chip, it absolutely screams.
Oh yeah. That's one of those cars that, it's actually, a lot of people ask me the difference between an alcohol funny car and a fuel funny car, as far as driving them. There's a lot of alcohol funny car that's actually harder to drive than a nitro funny car. It's a lot more mental than an alcohol funny car because you have to do a lot. There's a lot to do. I mean, you have to, up in the starting line, you have to rev it up. You have to be on a RPM that the crew chief tells you he wants you to leave at, and you have to load the clutch yourself with your foot, and you have to do that with your foot in the brake and stage the car and cut a good light and get ready to shift it and steer it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to do in an alcohol funny car. And I've always said it's more difficult to win an alcohol funny car than it is, because in the nitro funny car, now that's a whole nother animal, but it's a different animal. It's just a beast. It's just, with an alcohol funny car, the hard part is getting through the first gear change, because it almost always wants to shake the tires in an alcohol car because it just doesn't have the horsepower to overcome that tire spin sometimes. But in a fuel funny car, the thing has so much horsepower, it's just accelerates from start to finish. Whereas the alcohol funny car, after you get through that first gear change, you're pretty much just waiting for second and third gear. You can pretty much cruise and drive around the track. It's a very forgiving car. Even though the beginning of driving the car at the light at the beams is harder, once you get through the first gear change, it's sort of like a Sunday drive, but not in a fuel funny car. A fuel funny car is an animal from start to finish, and you can't hesitate 1 second on the steering, because it will get away from you that quick, because the nitro funny car moves so quick. It moves faster than you can think, right? You're not thinking when you're driving that car. You're actually reacting to it by the seat of your pants. And so if you're not ahead of the steering on the fuel funny car and it drops a cylinder, it'll get away from you. It'll go over the center line. You still see veteran drivers, even myself and guys like John Force and Tim Wilkerson, you'll see it get away from them. Because that's how fast it can get away from you. Even the best of the best, it'll get away from them. So you literally have to be on top of the steering on a nitro funny car from start to finish, because that thing just accelerates and doesn't hesitate 1 second in acceleration. So it's a challenge. Both cars have their own sets of challenges.
Yeah, that was one of the things, I was going to say there is that, an alcohol funny car does weird things and you got to pay attention while it's trying to kill you. A nitro car just tries to kill you the entire length of the track any way possibly it can, moving around. It's hard for people to understand unless you either in the driver's seat or you're standing, seeing these things move trackside. And like you said it perfectly, it gets away from the best one because you're trying to react, predict what this thing might or might not do, and there's a million things it might do. When it does it, it's not, what was that? It was, this is happening right now, and I need to do something about it.
Well, that's the challenge. I mean, a lot of people, they look at our sport from the outside, and they say, oh, you just have to drive straight, and that's all you do. It's easy, right? You just drive straight. But they don't understand that, 125-inch wheelbase nitro funny car with the engine in its location where it is doesn't want to go straight. I mean, we have the downforce, we have the big rear wing, we have a lot of nice aerodynamic bodies, but, when things are good, yeah, that's not so bad. But a lot of times when it's dropping cylinders, it can get really hairy really quick. And that's when, you really get your attention, is when it's not going so good.
Oh, yeah, that's... I could only imagine, especially when you're watching, you know, I watch a lot of the races on NHRA.tv, and they'll show the ISO shots from the top end when stuff starts going kind of crazy. And those cars are just sashaying across the track at all times. And, you know, it's almost like a rarity to see something go like dead center A to B.
Yeah. And on the very, very best runs, you know, it'll go down straight down the track. I mean, you still have to steer it. It looks like, well, it's a perfectly close, you know, you'll people say, well, that's a perfectly straight run. And sometimes you don't have to do a lot of steering on a run, but a lot of times you do. And a lot of times people don't notice how much steering you're doing in the car. I mean, sometimes you have those in-car camera shots and it does show how much you're turning the steering wheel. I think they're cool camera shots, because it shows how much the driver is actually steering the car, even though it looks like a perfectly straight run.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing it doesn't take into account is, yeah, you know, you're yanking on that little butterfly wheel quite a bit, but the physical forces that are being imposed upon you make that a little bit of a challenge as well.
Oh, when it drops the cylinder and it's starting to push you one way or the other, it takes every bit of strength that you can to turn that steering wheel. I mean, I use my, you know, all my arm muscles to actually turn it as hard as possible. And sometimes that's not even enough.
Oh, yeah. It's just wanting to do it. And then, you know, God forbid, if the chassis unloads or one wheel spins more than the other, then it's going to do something else funky. And then you're in a whole different weird world of trying to figure out what it wants to do.
Yeah.
And the other thing is with the funny cars, too, that, you know, people don't realize is when they start getting upset and start thrashing around with that wheelbase and the ways that those things are weighted, you guys kind of have your hands full trying to keep it under control at that point, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the challenge of driving those cars. That's why, you know, people say, you know, I mean, you know, I have a top fuel dragster license as well. I've driven a top fuel dragster, three or four races back in 2009. I drove the Laganas family's second dragster. I got my license and drove a couple of IHRA races in top fuel. But I've always been a funny car guy, because that's what, to me, I mean, dragsters are cool. They're a different kind of cool. They're really like very, very fast go-karts. I mean, they're just acceleration machines. But the funny car is to me, it's my personal preference, is the most challenging car to drive, a nitro funny car, because of the steering. You just literally have to steer from start to finish. You have a lot of things that could go wrong, you know, weight transfer, one tire gripping more than another, cylinders going out, trying to keep it in the groove. Some tracks have tight grooves, some tracks, you know, have a wide groove. You know, it's a lot more challenging in the tracks with a tight groove, meaning you literally don't have much room to go right or left. You literally need to keep it in the middle of the track. Otherwise, if one tire gets out of that groove, it'll start smoking the tires or drop a cylinder. Then it starts, you know, wanting to move faster or, you know, move harder to one way or the other. So, yeah, I like the challenge of it. That's why I love driving these cars, is because of the challenge.
What kind of story could you tell us around this? You're driving one of these cars at one point where something happened, you're like, oh, this is going to be a problem, or this is going to be kind of a wild ride.
Well, I mean, one of the worst things that could ever happen in one of these cars is the throttle hanging open. And that's happened to me twice.
Oh.
And one time it was in racing IHRA. It was in Paul Richards' car, and we were at Epping, New Hampshire, an IHRA race. And they had done some modifications to the body before the race. And I guess we didn't check when we put the body down that it actually was rubbing on the throttle cable. And we didn't notice that. So when I made the first run down the track, this is quarter mile now too, mind you. This is back in the day, a quarter mile. So we make the run. It's on a really good run. And all of a sudden I go to lift and I can't lift. And the car is, you know, we already went 300 miles an hour, and now it's going faster. It's just accelerating. And it's like the throttle hung wide open. And that could be disaster. And so luckily for us, we were at New England Dragway, which is a very long track. So the first thing I did was I reached over, and, you know, the only thing you can do is try to keep steering it. You can't let it get out of control. And just you have one arm on the steering wheel, and then you're reaching for the fuel shutoff, and you have to shut the fuel off. Now, you know, when you shut the fuel off on one of these things and it's got a wide open throttle, it's going to blow up. So you know it's going to blow up, but you got to stop the car, right? So I hit the fuel shut off, and within a second, it leaned out and blew the windshield. It blew the blower off of it and blew the windshield out of it. But it stopped the engine, and I was able to get it stopped before going off the end of the track. Now, if that was at a shorter track, it would have crashed. So luckily for me, I was able to get to the fuel shut off. It's one of those things where you have in your head that you don't think about it. You automatically do it. If this happens, this is what you do. So being a driver, you go through those kinds of scenarios in your head. If this happens, this is what you do. So luckily for me, I had, gone through all those scenarios for years, but it never happened. And all of a sudden it did happen. So I was able to get to the fuel shut off, which shut the fuel off. Now there's a lot more. This has been 10, 11 years. Now there's a lot more safety equipment that you could rely on where I wouldn't have had to done that. We have the automatic shutoff now at the end of the track. So if the throttle hangs open now in a modern car, they have the automatic shutoff at the end that will automatically shut the car down. And that all became after the Scott Collette accident, all that technology came about. So we have different technology now that's a lot safer. But back then, we didn't have that. The only thing I could do is get to the fuel shut off, try to shut it off, and you know it's going to blow up. Luckily, it didn't blow the engine up. I mean, it could have blew the engine up from leaning out, but it basically just blew the blower off of it and blew the windshield out of it. But was able to get, so in the grand scheme of things, we got lucky.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But anyway, that was pretty scary.
I was going to say, out of all the different scenarios that could happen, a bang blower and slightly torn up body is a heck of a lot better than everything else that could have happened there for sure.
Oh, yeah, crashing the car, it got hurt and lose my life. I mean, it's pretty serious when you're going that fast, that you have that much energy, 300 miles an hour with a 2,500-pound car. There's a lot of energy there. And that was the best case scenario as a result. I was actually pretty happy with that.
I've been at the top end when a pro mod had the chutes fail or start to fail, and he was going 250 miles an hour. And as a racer and, in this situation, with what I do, when something's not right. And when that car went smoking past us at the speed it was going at past the scales up at Norwalk, I go, man, he's in trouble. And that's the worst feeling on earth, because there's very few good things are going to come out of a car moving that fast heading towards the top end with no way to stop, let alone a stuck throttle in a nitro car. That'd be worst case scenario nightmare in my mind.
Well, it is. I mean, in a nitro car, that is the worst case scenario, is the throttle hanging open, because, like I said, they've come a long way with the safety equipment. NHRA has done a great job with that. And now we have these automatic shutoffs. So if that does happen, the car will shut off at the finish line, shortly after the finish line. The electronics will shut the ignition off.
Kind of going off of that right there, you mentioned it was quarter mile racing, and the internet's been a buzz, and we put something out there about, I talked with Joe Costello last week about it, the idea of possibly going back to quarter mile racing for at some events for some of the nitro cars. And there's a lot of people that are for and against it. I mean, there's a lot of different things floating around out there. From the racer standpoint, would you be on board with racing quarter mile nitro, just the driving side of it?
Well, I mean, yeah, of course. Quarter mile is what I started on, and that's what real to me is a real drag race. But it's a lot more complicated than that.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But as far as a pure just me as a driver, yeah, I love quarter mile. That's to me, that's drag racing. But to get there is a whole different story.
Yeah. I was going to say from the team owner side and everything else, what's that side of it look like?
Yeah, from a team owner side, I don't know how, there's a lot more detail that has to be worked out on that, but I don't know how they would do that. Because, these cars are, these engines are built to run 1,000 feet and really no more. So you'd have to change the tune-up to go back to quarter mile, which I'm not a crew chief, but I know that it would take different parts and pieces and maybe different kinds of tune-up part, and they would have to have two different combinations, sort of like when you go to Denver. Denver is a high-altitude track, so everybody has a little bit different piston and rod compression combination when they go there, as opposed to the rest of the tracks. And I think if they had some tracks that were quarter mile, I think you'd have to have a different combination to run a quarter mile than you know, and other combination for 1,000 feet. And I think that would be more expensive. But like I said, I'm open-minded and always listen to, you know, I always want to help the sport. If you know, the sport needs to move forward. If this is what people want, then let's figure out a way to do it. If it's not what they want, then we won't. I mean, you know, we need to work together. You know, a lot of times when they, you know, when people ask certain NHRA drivers or, a lot of times they ask the drivers what they want to do, and they're not the ones paying the bills. You know, the drivers aren't paying the bills. It's the car owners are paying the bills, and the sponsors are paying the bills, and the spectators are paying the bills, right? The fans, that's the number one thing. They're the ones that are paying our bills, not these drivers that get a hired driver. They're, you know, they ask their opinion, and they're just going to give their self-interested opinion, right? You need to ask the people who pay the bills, which is the owners, the sponsors, and the fans. That's who you need to, you know, talk to and try to move the sport forward. If that's what people want, and then we have to get our heads together and solve a problem like any other business. You know, we want to move the sport in forward and get more popular, especially with the younger crowd.
Oh yeah.
And what do they want to see? You know, I mean, this is, you know, to me, it's the fans are the most important ones to listen to. Not the hired drivers. I wouldn't even listen to a hired driver. You got to, you know, listen to the people who pay the bills, and mostly the fans.
Oh yeah, that totally makes sense. And there's a lot of people that, you know, have kind of been watching social media feedback and some of the feedback we got on the article that we put about, you know, the idea of it going back. And a lot of people, you know, from that aspect of it, really want to see it go back to quarter mile racing. And then at the same time, you know, it's what like Joe and I discussed is, you know, yeah, well, we love to see it as, you know, the pure fan side. You know, I grew up watching quarter mile racing, nitro racing, absolutely. But again, it's like you said, the part side and everything else, that everything it you got to go into changing. It's like when you see guys that go from running, you know, the PDRA eighth mile to NHRA quarter mile pro mile racing, there's a lot of changes that have to be made to keep the car alive and happy on top of figuring out everything else.
Yeah. There's, I mean, especially in nitro engines are like that. I mean, they're built to go 1,000 feet and no more, you know, I mean, so you're going to have another, like I said, I'm not a crew chief, you know, whatever they can figure out and NHRA can figure out, I'm on board with them. I mean, I want to work, you know, we need to work with NHRA together, and we are. I mean, NHRA has been really, really good lately. As far as, with the track prep, they backed off the track prep, which I thought was a great idea. It makes it more competitive for the single car teams like myself. There's only three big teams. You have John Force, you have the Colettas, and you have Schumacher Racing. For anybody else to come out there racing, why go out there and race if we can't be competitive? So I think one of the best moves that NHRA has done in years is change the track prep mixture to back it off to allow, you know, cars to be competitive. Guys like me and some other single car teams, we can go out there and you know, maybe not run as fast as the top guys, but we can be in the middle of the pack and actually have a chance to win. That's what it's all about. If we can't have a chance to win, then why even bother? You know, I wouldn't even bother racing if I don't have a chance to win. So I think one of the best moves in the right direction is the track prep. I thought that was great, and I think that they're trying to find other ways to, you know, get more cars out there to make it more competitive, and that's what we need to grow the sport. We need more cars.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I mean, you hit the nail on the head right there. Even in the playing field, as far as the big teams versus the small teams, and you know what they can do in keeping it competitive. Because if you're able to, you know, force the big teams to really stay on their toes, it makes interesting. And then you got guys like Steve Torrance, who's, you know, isn't part of one of those big teams, and you know, look what he's done to that poor, you know, Top Fuel field, just brutalizing those guys at any chance he could get.
Yeah, they're doing it. I mean, I know Bobby Lagana for many, many years, and he's part of that team, and what they've done is outstanding. A single car team to be able to dominate like they have, it's just incredible when you think about it.
Oh, and those guys always look like they are just having the greatest time ever. They're not worried about corporate sponsors. They're just, it reminds me a lot of like the old school days, and even to a point where when Force used to really kind of let it rip from the hip, you know, stuff like that, where you tend to be like, all right, what's this guy going to say next? You know, well, you know, that's what you want to see.
Well, I know those guys are definitely having fun. That's for sure. And that's what it's all about at the end of the day, having fun. And I know that's what we do with our new team now, is that we have a really good team. Jim Oberhopper is a crew chief. We have Donnie Bender. We have a lot of really good experienced guys, even though we're part-time. All our crew guys have been on teams full-time before. They just choose, you know, they have other things like jobs or families, whatever, and they just don't want to be on the road full-time. So with our part-time team, it allows them to come out, race on the level that we're racing, but only do it on a part-time basis. So we have a really good crew of experienced guys. I mean, none of our guys are basically new. They're all former full-time crew members on top teams, but they're now, you know, have other things going on in life where they come out and, you know, we all race together. We have a really good time and we race hard. We have a good time, but we're out there to try to win rounds. That's our goal.
Yeah, I was going to kind of, you know, parlay into that the next thing, you know, kind of tell us about, you know, how your season's gone so far and what it's like kind of coming back into the foray now, you know, what's changed and, you know, what's it like to be in this newish era of nitro racing?
Well, I mean, a lot of it, had to do with, you know, the track prep being changed. That made my decision. You know, I was signed off by my cardiologist to come back to drive. But how I was going to come back and drive, you know, wasn't decided last year. So originally I was going to maybe do a third car again with Coletta Motorsports, and a lot of things happened last year with the Coletta organization. Jim Oberhopper, who we call Jimmo, he left and moved on to Straight Line Strategy Group with Clay Milliken's team. So I decided to go in a different direction, talk with Jimmo, who's been a longtime friend of mine, and he wanted to be the crew chief, and I wanted him to be the crew chief. So we decided, okay, what do we do? You know, how do we put together our team? So we talked to Don Schumacher, and Don said, basically, okay, whatever you guys want, we could take care of it. You know, I can sell you guys anything you guys need, you know, we got. So Don Schumacher has been really, really great to us. You know, I couldn't say better things about Don. I mean, you know, a lot of people look at him. He's the big team out there. But I'll tell you what, the guy loves the sport of drag racing and wants to help it grow. And by helping guys like me on a single car team, shows that he really does want to see the sport grow. He wants to see more cars out there. He doesn't want to be racing himself, you know. He wants it. So he's been extremely helpful. Anything we needed, pretty much, he rented me a space in his shop. So we basically, our team is parked at Don Schumacher Racing. We're parked right next to the NAFTA team. And Jim O is working with Ron Tobler, which is Ron Capp's crew chief, the NAFTA car. And we're like a sister car to the NAFTA car. So Jim O and Ron Tobler work closely together, and that's basically why our car has been successful so fast. We've been able to build our car as a copycat car to the Ron Capps NAPA car. And our setup is exactly like his. All the parts we bought were from Don Schumacher. Even the truck and trailer was Matt Hagen's old rig that he got a new rig a couple years ago, and our rig is his old one. So pretty much everything that we have, we bought from Don Schumacher Racing. The only things that we didn't buy is stuff that they didn't have, like, you know, race pack computers and some other things like that that they didn't have spares of, so we had to buy new. So basically our whole team is, you know, like a satellite car, sort of like Bob Tasca. He works through Don Schumacher Racing as well. He also rents space in a different part of Don Schumacher's facility, but we're actually in the main part of the facility. And anything we need, we buy from Don Schumacher Racing. Any kind of repairs we need, we pay them. We even our wrap on our car, we pay Don Schumacher Racing. They have a wrap department. So it basically, we're a customer for Don, and you know, we're housed right there, and it's really helped us tremendously to be able to go to the races and have our setup to be, you know, similar to Ron Tobler's setup, and him and Jimmo talk between each round and look at the way we run. That's one of the main reasons. For one, we have good guys. Jimmo's a great crew chief, And him and Ron Tobo have a long-lasting working relationship, which is, it's when you see them two work together, it's really quite incredible and impressive. So, you know, that's why we've been able to go out there, run fast, not hurt any parts, and we've only raced 3 times. So we just have nothing but optimism looking for the rest of the year and going into the future.
You know, jumping in like the way you did, I think is probably one of the smart things to do, is kind of semi-attach yourself to one of these teams. And is that something where it also helps Schumacher, where they have the ability to kind of pick your guys' brain on something you might have done and go, hey, you know, how did that work out? Does that help move everybody forward?
Well, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, if Ron wants to try something in our car, he's free to do it. And I'll give you an example, like at Norwalk on the last qualifying run. On Q4 on Saturday, so we were earlier in the run, and we set up our car. You know, the air was a little cooler, and the guys wanted to try something, so we tried in our car. We ran a 3.91 with a 6, and that was the fastest time I've ever run, and it was a number 3 qualifier. So, and then the Cap's car and Ron Tobler were a couple pairs back, and they did something to their car, where they went up and ran a 3.91 with a 4. And we were the fastest 2 cars in that qualifying session. So Ron, in that qualifying session, Ron Capps was number 1 and I was number 2. And our cars ran identical 3.91s, his with a 4, mine with a 6. So there you show the sharing of information. You know, if we can help Ron Tobler, Ron Capps, that's what we want to do.
Yeah, you know, being able to pull data, let alone resources together like that, you know, helps everybody out across the board. And with what you guys do, you know, how much data are you able to really, you know, use from their side of things to apply to your car and kind of learn from?
Oh, the cars are identical, so a lot.
And when I guess with the data, you know, maybe peel back a little bit on that, you know, what kind of data do, you know, from, you say you're not a crew chief, but some of the fans out there might want to know, what kind of data are you guys able to really kind of mine from each pass to learn from? You know, what are you looking at to try to make a car go faster?
Well, I mean, like I said, I mean, I'm not a crew chief, but I can kind of listen to what they're working on. And a lot of it is, you know, the blower overdrive and the clutch flows and basically the clutch setup, you know, the clutch setup with the fuel system, you know, that's the heart of it. You know, I mean, they all agree on what the compression should be based on the air. That's a pretty much a given. So, you know, when they're up there, they're reading the track, they're looking at what's going on up there, and they're maybe changing the timing in the ignition and then changing clutch flows and timing. That's kind of, you know, how they, you know, make quick changes up there. They can, like, we've been the next pair, and Jimmo's come over and opened up the computer box and changed the timing, and we've, you know, made a good run based on, you know, timing map that he makes a change on based on what just happened in front of us. You know, maybe someone smoked the tires, or maybe there was an oil down, or the track got a little hotter, or, you know, maybe there was some cloud cover that came over. You know, all that stuff matters on the track. So when the crew chiefs read the track and they come back and they make changes, what they think is going to maximize the performance on the track based on the track conditions and the, you know, the heat of the day and the track temperature and the air and all those combinations of things. That's why those guys get the big money.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that always fascinates me. I crew on a radial tire car, and it's, you know, a completely different animal entirely, but it's always, you know, the nerd side of me likes to hear about kind of the different stuff that goes in, you know, what these machines do, because they are so different and difficult to get down a track.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see different drivers have different roles. You know, most of the time you'll see a driver packing their own chutes. You know, some of them at different levels get kind of, you know, more in depth with what they do on the car. Do you do anything that's kind of as part of, you know, helping wrench on the car? Are you just packing the chutes and just doing your own thing?
Well, for many years, I was the clutch guy. I used to do the clutch on the car and drove the car. I did that for many, many years, whether on alcohol and on nitro cars. I used to do the clutch and drive it. Nowadays, I'm just too old to do that. My shoulders are worn out. The torque, you know, back in the old days, we used to torque the clutch covers to 120 pounds, 110 pounds. Now they're torquing these covers with the big 5/8 studs. They're torquing them to close to 200 pounds. I only weigh 150. So I was like, I give that job to the young guys, you know, the young, strong guys. So I kind of gave up that job. So pretty much now I just pack the chutes. That's about it.
And anybody that's tried to torque something down to over 200 pounds knows exactly what you're talking about there, that takes a lot of oomph to get done.
Yeah, I said if you want to give me a 6 foot long torque wrench, I could probably do it. But other than that, you're going to have to get a young guy in here.
Yeah. That's what.
So I stopped doing the clutch about 10 years ago. But I did it for many years. I enjoyed that part of it. I enjoyed working on the car. You know, it's sort of my, you know, that bell housing was sort of my expertise, and hence I'm in the clutch business here. But, you know, but that's always been my background and interest. I've always been interested in it. So, but it's something that physically now it's just too demanding.
And kind of going off of that, you know, you said McLeod Clutch is your guys, is your company. And is there anything, are you able to even use the nitro cars, the alcohol cars, as a test bed on what you can bring to consumers or things you can learn from that? Or is it just too exotic?
It's just different. I mean, McLeod makes, we specialize in the high performance street market, aftermarket. So, you know, your Mustangs, your Camaros, your Corvettes, your Dodge Challengers, you know, we make replacement clutches for your modern stick shift car, and also for your, you know, muscle cars, you know, your old Camaros, 57 Chevys, any of the old stick cars. We make clutches for pretty much anything that has a stick shift in it that's American made. We also do some foreign, some export, import stuff. So we make some, you know, some Subaru, we make some, BMW stuff, and some other things, but mostly our history has been in the domestic performance market. So our expertise is pretty much on the street stuff. And we do some racing. We do some like stock, super stock, door car stuff. You know, our soft lock clutch has been a staple in stock and stick shift door cars for many years. But other than that, the higher performance, like the nitro cars, they use a sintered iron disc, which is a metal disc. That's not really something that you would run on the street. It's just not a street friendly material for the street. I mean, there are a few guys here and there that will run a sintered iron disc on the street, but they're definitely a hardcore, high horsepower, hardcore drivers. That, you know, it's not a daily driver kind of a thing, because it would not be friendly as a daily driver. So to answer your question, not really. Then, like I said, the alcohol, the nitro stuff, and Promod—that's all sintered iron material. That's just that, you know, a lot of guys are using torque converters now anyway, and trans is in the Promod stuff, but in the alcohol stuff, they're still clutch guys. But they're, like I said, it's mostly a sintered iron stuff that we don't really use for the street.
And something like touch on there is you mentioned with McLeod, you guys do, you know, the old school and the new school stuff. With the power that these modern muscle cars are coming out with now and the combinations, what have you guys been able to do at McLeod to kind of, you know, step up to that market when some guy rolls off the lot with a really, you know, gnarly LS powered Corvette? You know, what can you guys do, or what have you guys done to figure out those cars and give them an option to be able to hold more power?
Yeah, well, that's where McLeod has been the leader. These high performance cars coming out of Detroit muscle cars, the late model stuff. They all have double disc clutches in them, because that's what you need to handle the power. You know, many years ago, Red Roberts, the founder of McLeod, came up with a double disc clutch for the street back in the 80s. And everybody in industry told Red, "Yo, you're nuts. You don't need two discs on the street." And look at us now. All the high performance cars coming out of Detroit, like the Mustangs and the Corvettes and the Camaro, they all have double discs in them. And that's something that McLeod just happened to be on the forefront many, many years ago. So bring us to today. Our RXT, McLeod RXT, and the McLeod RST, and the McLeod RXT, the 1200, handles those high horsepower cars. So we've been developing a double disc clutch since the 80s, and we've been able to modernize it with the material where now we have a clutch that you could put right in your late model street car. It handles much horsepower, up to 1200 horsepower, and is a daily driver. And you have a clutch that'll handle the power, and it'll be light on the pedal, just like stock. So, I mean, we've had people call and push in the clutch and say, "Hey, there's something wrong and it's too easy." No, that's the way it is. That's a daily driver. That's the way the clutch should be. So our technology, you know, today's world, and that's why McLeod leads in the double disc market, is because we have that that RXT models that handle the high horsepower for daily drivers on the street. That's our biggest selling clutches. We just sell thousands of those things.
It's funny you mentioned the ease of pushing in. That if you've ever driven, like, you know, a more tame factory car clutch, and then you go to something that's got a full on race clutch, it's a little bit of a wake up call when you try to push that thing in.
Yeah, that's what makes the RXT, the McLeod RXT, so great. Is it has that very, very light pedal pressure, lighter than it's as light as stock, but it'll handle 1,200 horsepower.
Now, when someone's going to look to select the clutch, you know, is there something you guys recommend, or is there a difference on what they need to go with as far as if they're using a, you know, a power adder, you know, the different power adders, even just boost and nitrous, or are they all pretty much the same on what they should select?
Well, no, I mean, yeah, every car is, you know, that's one of the things about clutches is different. Is, and another reason our tech department is so busy is recommendations. You know, people will call and, you know, the kind of car you have, you know, how heavy is the car? You know, what kind of tires do you have on it? I mean, what do you use it for? Is it street strip, just street? You know, how do you, what's your driving habits? You know, so all that stuff matters in clutch selection. So, you know, if your local dealer, you know, can't help you, we have a great tech department here at McLeod that can help you choose, you know, the right clutch for you and give you a part number so that you can go to, you know, a Summit or a Jags or one of our dealers around the country and buy the clutch at a good price.
And just beside the clutch alone, too, you need to make sure you have the right flywheel for one of these modern setups as well to make sure that it's going to be balanced and react how you want to react, right?
Well, the flywheel, you know, that's, you know, one of the unique things of the RXT is you don't have to buy a new flywheel. We're the only clutch company that offers a double disc where you don't have to buy a dedicated flywheel. And that's because of our patented adapter ring. If you've seen an RXT, you see that anodized colored ring. It's either gold, black, or red. That is an adapter ring, and that will adapt to your current flywheel. So if you have a new car, just say you buy a brand new car and your flywheel is fine. Well, with our RXT, you don't have to buy a new flywheel. You can use your existing flywheel, take your old clutch off, and our adapter ring fits right onto your current flywheel. Now, if you have an older flywheel and you want to buy a new one, obviously we can set you up with a new flywheel as well, balance everything here at the shop. But technically, you don't. It's one of the big advantages of our double disc clutches. Like I said, you don't have to buy a new flywheel. If you have a good flywheel, then you save. You know, you could save $400 or $500 on a flywheel by not having to buy a new one by buying the RXT.
And kind of going off of some of the other stuff that you guys do, I remember MPMC. You guys mentioned that you started doing some other stuff just besides, you know, the typical clutches, right? You do other driveline parts too.
But yeah, we're a complete driveline company. We build, we do a lot of hydraulic throw-up bearings. I mean, if a customer is interested in changing his mechanical throw-up bearing to hydraulics or replacing the current hydraulic bearing, we sell lots of hydraulic throw-up bearings. Of course, we make flywheels. We have bell housing. We have an aluminum bell housing with a titanium inner liner that's SFI approved that weighs 13 pounds. So that's another popular item. We make transmissions. We make the Muscle Car 5 transmission. We make shifters. Everything from the back of the crank to the drive shaft we make.
And, you know, kind of something I was thinking about the other day towing my car is, you know, a lot of guys might not necessarily think about their tow vehicles and upgrading the transmissions or, you know, really going through those. Is that something you guys can typically help a customer with on a truck?
Yes, we do. We have the automatic transmission rebuild kits for pretty much every kind of transmission and their performance. We have a partnership with Rebestos, and it's called McLeod Rebestos Automatic Performance Transmission Rebuild Kits. It has all the high performance clutch plates in it and everything you need to upgrade your automatic transmission, especially for tow vehicles.
Yeah, I was going to say, because it's something that might slip a lot of racers' minds, but something they need to think about, because towing a race car and a trailer with a bumper pull truck can put a lot of stress on that transmission. You need to make sure that thing's going to be able to put up with what you're trying to put it through.
And we sell a lot of kits to exactly that, to guys that are, you know, have a truck with, you know, that are using a tow vehicle that want to beef up their transmission. We sell the kit that will do that. And it's very inexpensive, too.
It's a good solid peace of mind to have for something that you might not think about. You don't want to be stranded alongside the road trying to figure out how to limp a hurt truck and trailer home.
Right.
And, you know, as we start to wrap things up here, I like to, with all my hardcore racers, I kind of like to pose a question to them. And, you know, you're all about the nitro racing and whatnot. What's another class that you might, if you could race another class besides funny cars, and we'll even get rid of top fuel dragster, because you said during that too, outside of the nitro ranks, what's something else you might want to drive that you've never really driven before?
Well, I've pretty much driven. I didn't start at the top. I mean, I pretty much started with my mom's car when I was 17 years old. She had a 6-cylinder Plymouth Duster that I used to go bracket racing in Echo Dragway on Friday nights. That's how I started. And then I pretty much gradually, you know, went, you know, a little faster, a 13-second car, then a 12-second car. Then I raced Super Gas for a year or two, and then I went, the car was too fast for that. Then I ran Super Pro, and I pretty much worked my way up. I pretty much driven everything all the way up from a 6-cylinder, 18-second car all the way up to now a 3-second nitro funny car. So I've pretty much driven it all. I mean, the only thing I haven't really driven is like a pro stock or a pro mod. I haven't driven those. But, you know, pretty much any kind of dirt car, like I said, I've been drag racing for, you know, close to, man, I'm getting that old. Damn, it's like 40 years. So it was like, I've pretty much driven everything from like my mom's car all the way up to the nitro funny car. I guess maybe... I think pro mod is kind of cool. I like that. I mean, pro stock are, you know, they're cool too, a different way. But I think the pro mods are pretty badass.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you, if pro mod would be something interesting, because it's something that's really fast with doors, and it definitely has a lot in common with a funny car, because it's so rowdy to try to keep going down the track and make sure it's doing what you want it to do.
Yeah, you know, I've seen them, and I have a lot of friends that drive them, and they've offered a few times, some of my friends that have pro mods, hey, why don't you come out and take it for a spin? Nah, not really. I'll leave that to you. I'll stick to what I know.
It's funny listening to different drivers talk about that stuff, and some of them are all about it, and, you know, the nitro guys will look at some of the pro mod guys and be like, you're insane, I'm not getting behind the wheel of that. And then the pro mod guys will be like, I'm good. I like not having an angry bomb in front of me or behind me. And it's kind of interesting to see how different people want to react. And you got people like Stevie Fast, who I'm pretty sure he'd race anything with an engine and probably most things without.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's the same thing. What you just said is absolutely true. And I'll tell you, give me an example. Steve Matuzak is a friend of mine. Right. So Steve's like, hey, try my car. I'm going, no way. And yeah, I go, try mine. He goes, no way. So,
yeah, they definitely have different reactions. Then, you know, someone like Alex Laughlin, who I've seen, you know, he did some small tire racing, saw him down at South Georgia at the Outlaw stuff, and saw him.
He'll drive anything.
Yeah. Literally.
He's very talented. And he can drive it too, and he can drive it good.
Yeah, it's kind of been interesting that people kind of were heckling him about getting into small tire racing, and all of a sudden, you know, he jumped in and won that big event, and now he's not that NHRA guy's here. He earned a lot of street credit quickly in that form of racing.
Yeah.
And now he's trying to jump into no prep, which again is a whole nother completely different animal. What's your take on that no prep stuff?
I think it's awesome. I mean, I think anything that what people like, and drag racing's got a lot of different parts to it. I mean, you know, I like it all, you know, no matter what you race. I mean, I respect it all. It doesn't matter if you drive a 17-second street car, which I've done. That's how I started, all the way up to, you know, no prep or whatever you race. If you're a drag racer, then I'm with you. I don't care what you race.
That's
generally... I respect it all.
That's generally my consensus too when it comes to drag racing. I love it all. You know, it's funny, when I was, you know, in college, you know, the Fast and the Furious came out. You know, I'm a muscle car guy at heart, and the import guys are always kind of chirping around a little bit and kind of discounted it till you start seeing more well-built imports. And then I went to the World Cup up at MDIR, and you see the fastest imports in the world, and that's kind of a life-changing experience. And you see some of those cars running in the 5-second range now. It's insane.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we have a lot of customers, all different kinds of racing, that race stick shift cars. I mean, there's a lot of, There's a few stick shift only circuits around North America, like in VC Super Shifters, for example, up in Canada. They have a little circuit where they race maybe 8 or 10 races, and it's all stick shift cars.
Well, you got the UMTR guys here out east, yeah, along with the Southeast Gassers, and those are just, that's a lot of fun to watch because those things are wild.
Yeah, well, it's more fun than watching a stick shift car, you know, going through the gears, going down the track. Nothing to me.
Oh, no, I definitely have a lot of respect for the guys that go fast with a stick shift car that can bang those gears like that, because there's a lot going on inside the cockpit of those cars, especially when you dump that clutch and that thing's going to want to really get kind of crazy right off the hit. And then you see, like at the World Cup, some of those import cars, and those guys are banging gears going down the track with a car that you have to keep your foot in it to keep it happy, so they really don't have the option to lift per se if they want to really make the car do what it's supposed to do.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's all cool stuff. I love it all.
Awesome. Well, Paul, we appreciate your time, and I like to always give my guests at the end of the show a kind of the ability to do their best John Force impersonation and plug themselves, their sponsors, and what's going on. So why don't you tell our listeners out there where they can see more of you and what's going on in the world of Paul Lee.
Well, I mean, McLeodRacing.com. We have Instagram and our Facebook page. We have a lot of news and stuff on there. Our products are all on there. We have a dual locator. Anybody can look, to buy our stuff anywhere around the country. You can look on our dealer locator. As far as the drag racing goes, our next race is going to be at Brainerd, Minnesota, coming up in about 4 weeks. And that's our next race. And then we're going to be at the U.S. Nationals. Of course, we can't miss the U.S. Nationals, the biggest drag race of the year. So we're racing there. And then we'll race at Dallas, and we'll be back in Vegas for the SEMA show. And our car will be on display at the SEMA show. We also will have our booth in SEMA, so come by and visit us at the SEMA show. And then we'll finish off the year here in Pomona and at the L.A. Fairgrounds for the World Finals. That's our schedule for the rest of the year. And then, of course, we'll see everybody at the PRI show. We go there every year and display our products. And we're pretty excited about some new stuff that we have coming up that we'll be announcing shortly. Some really exciting news that people are going to enjoy. The company is going to be growing into different directions of driveline. So we're pretty excited about announcing that in the upcoming weeks. So a lot of exciting stuff going on.
Well, it sounds like it for sure. And thanks for coming on, Paul. I definitely appreciate it. And folks, make sure you go out and follow him on the social media channels and come out and get Paul's autograph at the track when he's throwing some nitro up in there and having a good time. But thanks again, Paul.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. It was a good time. Thanks.
For sure. Well, that wraps up the show for this week. Thanks to Paul for coming on and having some fun with us. And as always, may reaction times be crisp and your wind lights bright. Stay safe out there, folks. Until next time.